This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Last week, we were talking about how Iran launched missiles that seemed aimed at testing Donald Trump's resolve. Well, this week, it's North Korea that's launching missiles into the Sea of Japan, just as Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was visiting President Trump in the United States. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about how this missile test shows some impressive technological advancement for North Korea and how it could affect Japan and North Korea's other neighbors, as well as America and the Trump administration. Hamas, the Arab terrorist group in the Gaza Strip, has just selected a new leader. He's a very charismatic man with a lot of public support. He's also a hardliner with a serious past. He's a killer. Israelis held him in prison for 22 years before letting him go in a prisoner swap. Well, now he's in charge of the Gaza Strip, and some observers say this is a real blow to the possibility of peace between Arabs and Israelis. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about what this says about Palestinian politics and how this will affect Israel. Some serious weather disasters are hitting in the United States. Tornadoes in Louisiana, flooding in California after years of drought there. This is actually putting a lot of lives at risk. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Sam Livingston about why we need to look at these events in the bigger picture and ask ourselves, why natural disasters? And I'll conclude the program with a word about how to handle adversity, why it's important sometimes to keep wrestling even when you're in pain. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. This past Sunday, North Korea test-fired a ballistic missile. That's according to North Korean state-controlled news agency. And sources say this is quite a leap forward for North Korea's weapons capability. It really is putting North Korea's neighbors on edge as well. Japan's leaders expressed particular concern about how this would affect the security of Asia. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
So start by just telling us why this missile represents such an impressive technological step forward for North Korea.
Okay, sure. Well, yeah, there are actually three factors at play with this missile. This was called the Pukguksong-2 missile. And there are a few different aspects of this test that showcased some technological developments that really limit the ability of the United States and our allies, I think, to destroy North Korean missiles before they launch. The first of those is that it was fired from a tracked transporter erector launcher. These tracks are basically the continuous tracks or caterpillar tracks that we see on tanks instead of independent wheels. And they give the launch vehicle the ability to leave paved roads and fire from, you know, all kinds of rugged terrain. North Korea doesn't have a lot of paved roads. There are actually less than 500 miles of paved roads in the whole country. Wow. And so before this tracked launcher, the United States always thought that it would only have to monitor those 500 miles of paved roads. But now, with this new tracked launcher, North Korea could pretty much launch missiles from, well, not from anywhere in the country, but from a far greater number of potential launch points. So that just makes it much more difficult to track and to target. And the second one is that this Pukguksong-2 was cold launched from the launcher. Before this, North Korea apparently always used hot launches, which means the missile's main engines kick in from the very beginning. And that causes a lot of damage to the launch vehicle. It often prevents that launch vehicle from being able to be reused for a second launch. But cold launching means that compressed gas is used to propel the missile a small distance away from the launch vehicle. And at that point, then the main rocket engines kick in and launch it. And so that makes it much easier to quickly reuse the same launch vehicle for another launch. So that was a big development. And then the last technical detail of this launch that really, really makes it a possible game changer is that unlike North Korea's other medium-range ballistic missile, which uses liquid rocket fuel, this one uses solid rocket fuel. Liquid-fueled missiles have to be fueled up at or very near their launch positions, and that requires all kinds of support vehicles to be on hand. It makes them very easy to target and to track because there's essentially a whole motorcade, a whole convoy of military vehicles. But with this more modern solid fuel, it's loaded directly into the missile. It's always in there, and it means far fewer vehicles are needed, and the missile is pretty much always ready to go. So all of these factors just significantly reduce the ability to track and target this Pukguksong-2, which just means that it's likely that a preemptive strike on such a launch may no longer be possible.
So all of these developments that you're talking about, clearly it would have taken quite a long time to develop this technology. This is something that they've been at and working at for quite a long time. But the timing of the launch was very interesting. This happened just as Japan's prime minister was visiting Donald Trump in the United States. And so there's a couple of interesting elements there. First, let's just talk about, and you can just tell us about Japan's response to this.
Sure. Yeah, well, this I do think that that's a very significant aspect of this. It came while Mr. Abe was there in Florida with Mr. Trump, and those two have been trying to demonstrate their close allegiance ever since Mr. Trump came into power. And they're trying to show North Korea and China and other potential aggressors that the U.S.-Japan relationship is strong. So, you know, it's not a good time to be pushing against Japan or something like that.
And North Korea basically says, we don't care.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, they're saying, we hate this U.S.-Japan alliance, and here's what we think about it. And so they fire this missile into the Sea of Japan, which just infuriated the Japanese. And Japan feels concerned by this because they're very much within the range of this missile.
So North Korea, they aimed the missile in a way that would really put Japan on notice in particular.
I think so. I mean, it was clearly a test, and the U.S. says that it had, you know, it was monitoring the test. The U.S. says that had they noted that the trajectory could have actually, you know, made Japan a potential target, that they would have taken it down. But they noted that that trajectory was not, you know, endangering any of our allies, and so they didn't take it down. It's hard to know how much of that is true or is not. I would say most likely the U.S. could have brought it down. But one way or the other, though, just the proximity to mainland Japan there, it's of great concern to Abe. And then also this test came just a few days after the United States and South Korea announced that this year's joint military drills, the Key Resolve / Full Eagle joint drills, will be the largest ones that America and South Korea have ever held. Those kinds of announcements, those kinds of drills, they always infuriate North Korea. So this test launch could have been in large part a response to that announcement.
So Japan is Prime Minister Abe is in the United States. It's hard, certainly for an American like me, not to see this in the context of the fact that Donald Trump just took office. And you just wonder how much is North Korea testing Donald Trump's resolve.
It seems to me that they really wanted to wait until the inauguration had passed. Mr. Trump had a couple of weeks to settle in to the Oval Office there. And now I think they really are saying, here's what you told us we were not allowed to do. We just did it. Your move.
Yeah.
And
so what has been the Trump administration's move?
Well, so far it's been nothing beyond what we've seen with past administrations. It's been a rhetorical condemnation. In fact, Japan and the U.S. issued a joint statement since Mr. Abe was here that just said, we both disapprove of this. But there was little beyond rhetoric, at least so far. So I'm not sure if we should expect anything more than this. It does bring to mind a tweet that Mr. Trump posted. I think this was in early January, shortly after Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, had said that he was going to fire a long-range intercontinental ballistic missile. And Mr. Trump said, nope, it's not going to happen, something along those lines, in a pretty terse tweet. Now, this test was not an intercontinental ballistic missile. It was a medium-range or intermediate-range missile. But nevertheless, though, it's starting to look like Mr. Trump might be doing what politicians often do, which is say things and then maybe failed to deliver on what they've said.
We had just been talking about this with respect to Iran testing America's resolve and the mullahs in Iran trying to gauge just how serious Donald Trump was in some of the threats that he had made against them. It's really just a matter of time before somebody actually crosses exactly the red line that he established, and then the question becomes what are the consequences for that? I mean, it really, I guess it's kind of a wait and see game at this point, but so far the indications are that, well, maybe Donald Trump has a little bit more patience and forbearance than what people gave him credit for.
That's the way it looks. And you know, these sorts of conflicts are never quite as simple as it may look to an onlooker, an armchair general. But suddenly, if you're the commander in chief, you realize that it's not easy, and I'm not sure what we'll really expect there.
Right. So it's interesting to look at what's happening here in North Korea in light of the nuclear deal that President Bill Clinton made with that country back in 1994. That was the predecessor of the one that America made with Iran this past year. The mistakes of that deal in 94 continue to haunt us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's actually eerily similar to the Iran deal that President Obama made. If you look at the details and the rhetoric surrounding the nuclear deal that President Clinton made there with the North Koreans back in the 90s, and then what's sobering about that is that if you fast forward 12 years on from the time when that deal was made, you see that North Korea detonated their first nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. And since then, they've detonated plenty of others. And really, that's why these missile tests, like the one that happened on Sunday, are illegal, because they're in stark violation of UN resolutions and international laws. So at the time that the Clinton administration made that deal with North Koreans, they praised it as what was sure to be an era of peace on the, mm-hmm. you know, the Korean Peninsula, and it was going to stabilize Asia. And of course, it's done exactly the opposite.
Right. The idea that engagement was preferable to confrontation,
yes.
That engagement would be a better path toward mutual assurance of peace and so on.
Yes. And now, of course, we've heard the same rhetoric involving the Iran deal. This is the peace deal of the millennium and mm-hmm. and everything. And I just think if we look at that very recent history in North Korea, we see that there's very little cause for optimism regarding this Iran deal.
So with North Korea making these kinds of belligerent moves, this continuing this agitation coming from this little country with China's support, what can we expect from Japan, from South Korea going forward? How do they respond to this?
Well, I think we're already seeing in full force the Japanese and South Korean response, which is just these nations beginning to take their security and their defense capabilities much more seriously. They're bolstering all of their weapons programs, and all of that is just leading to kind of this self-perpetuating arms race that's happening across Asia. And so it's really just destabilizing the continent, and it's happening at a time when the U.S.'s security assurances are thinner every week. And so these nations feel more and more that as America's security guarantees are eroding, and as the threat from countries like North Korea are increasing, they've just got to begin to take charge of their own defenses.
Absolutely. We'll keep our eyes on it. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about North Korea's recent missile test. We have an article up at thetrumpet.com. North Korea ups the stakes with game-changing missile launch. This is an article written by trumpet writer Chris Eames. You can go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for talking about this, Jeremiah.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Relations between the Arabs and Jews in Israel are pretty tough right now. The UN saying Israeli settlements in the West Bank are illegal, uncertainty surrounding the Trump presidency and the effect that that's going to have on things. And now the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have chosen a new leader who could further complicate matters. Hamas, the Arab terrorist group that controls the Gaza Strip, is having some changes in its leadership. Some say that it does so in a way that will undermine the possibility of peace. To talk about this, I have trumpet writer Brent Noctegal via Skype from England. Hello, Brent.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. Good to have you. Tell us then about the changes within Hamas and about this new leader they've selected.
So Hamas is an organization that rules over one territory in the world, and that's the Gaza Strip, one of the two Palestinian territories. It's got over almost 2 million people here in this small territory, one of the most densely populated places in the world, actually. And it's got a number of leaders, one that would rule over that territory. And then you have what's known as the Political Bureau of Hamas that is led from right now Qatar, I believe, and sometime that's Turkey, where you've got exiled leaders of Hamas ruling from there. And the leadership change that's taken place is the one or is the leader that rules over the territory of the Gaza Strip. So he's a powerful, powerful figure because, again, this isn't just a terrorist group. This is ever since 2006, Israel withdrawn from the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinians have had their own state, basically. They have been ruling over the Gaza Strip for the past 10 years, and now we have virtually a new prime minister of the Gaza Strip. Hamas leader.
He doesn't have the title, but essentially that's his de facto position.
Right. He's replacing, actually, Ismail Haniyeh. He actually had the title prime minister. For some reason, this next man isn't getting the title of prime minister, but he is the undisputed head of the Gaza Strip. And this was of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and this was an election of sorts. It was done privately, internally, within the Hamas members are the ones that came forward to put this man into power. So it wasn't necessarily a vote of all the people. They did vote for Hamas to rule them, but now Hamas is putting the guy that they feel is best to represent them in power.
And tell us about this man. Quite a lot to talk about here.
Yeah, he's a very popular figure in the resistance against Israel. He's been imprisoned for about 22 years. He actually was during the first Intifada. So we're going back to the late 80s now. He was a Hamas operative right at the beginning of the establishment of Hamas as it broke away from or was developed from the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. It gradually exerted itself and power inside the Gaza Strip. And he was one of the people in its military wing that was in charge of ensuring that collaborators with Israel were found and then put to death. He's actually known as, from that period, he was known as the Man of the 12, the 12 being a reference to the 12 men at the time that he put to death at his own command. 12 collaborators. There was actually a fatwa that was issued by the cleric inside Hamas, Hamas's religious leader, that said that you do not need to go through a religious tribunal to put these people to death. You are able, as soon as they confess, to then put these people to death. And of course, he got confessions from every one of them.
So this is this is a man with quite a history, and what's particularly interesting, of course, this is the first time that we've had a leader of Hamas who has been selected from the military wing of the group, and you said he was in prison for 22 years. Maybe you could tell us how he got out, because this is very significant.
Yeah, it's very significant, and something we've been reporting on for years at the Trumpet is these prisoner swaps involving Israelis that are detained in Palestinian territories or up by Hezbollah in Lebanon. And then Israel will have this huge release of this unfair release of alive Palestinian murderers, a lot of them, some of them with blood on their hands, this guy being one of them, released in order to get their one soldier back. In this case, this was the deal where Gilad Shalit, that name's probably very familiar to people from he was captured by Hamas in the early 2000s in the Gaza Strip, and then in 2011 they eventually worked out some type of prisoner swap where 1,027 Palestinians were released for the one Israeli soldier to come back, and one of those was this guy that was released, Mr. Yahiwa Sinwa. He was released during that. He was the highest Hamas official to be released in that deal. And following that, Israel gets Gilad Shalit back. He goes straight to the Gaza Strip. He has a lot of fanfare, and there's a rally that's been created for his welcome. He speaks before 200,000 people. He talks about not compromising with Israel. It's interesting, actually, that he didn't even want this deal to go through because he believed that they could have got more Palestinian prisoners from Israel. So he was willing to sit in the prison for more than the 22 years because he knew that Israel would continually fold and weaken its negotiating position.
So this is something that the Trumpet, you mentioned that we've talked about it quite a bit, and we were by far from the only ones who drew attention to just the incredibly lopsided nature of this deal and how it would actually weaken Israel's position going forward. It seems like he really represents this chapter of weakness within Israel's history. How do Israelis feel as this man is coming to power, knowing his history and what he represents, and looking at the situation going forward?
Well, if you look back to the time that Gilad Shalit was released, it bitterly divided the state of Israel, very much so. There were many Israelis that didn't want this to happen. There were some that believed at all costs we need to get our soldiers back. So it might inflame old wounds inside the Israeli public. But going further than that, it's another case where one of these people have been released. Like it comes to mind, the other case with Hezbollah, I think it was in 2006, the Second Lebanon War, you had a couple of Israeli soldiers that were kidnapped by Hezbollah, which actually sparked the war. And then there was deliberations for years after that to get back the bones of those men. They were already killed. And to get back those bones, and some of the guys that were released from prison went ahead and committed murder again on Israelis once they were released back to Hezbollah. And this is a case right we have right now is this guy who went for the past 5 years has gradually been rising in popularity. He went right back to work for the Qassam Brigades, Hezbollah's military wing, and he's risen up through the ranks. And now he's going to rule over Hamas. And, I mean, we've talked about Hamas being a terrorist organization that is sworn to Israel's death. But now you have the most extreme, most uncompromising leader in that office that we've ever seen.
Pretty stark evidence of just the failure of that policy and the disaster it was for Israel in a way that even those who were detractors of that policy at the time probably wouldn't have foreseen this happening quite the way that it has. We've been watching and talking quite a long time about how recent events in particular are going to lead to more violence within Jerusalem and within Israel, and this certainly seems to be pushing things in that direction, does it not?
Yeah, there's a number of ways of looking at this. I mean, if we're going to conclude this discussion about, what can he do for Hamas, or where is it going to take the relationship between Israel? We could say he's going to want to start another uprising against the Jews, maybe start another offensive. There's been three wars against Israel from the Gaza Strip in the past decade. Is he going to start some rocket attacks or something like that? But what some people are saying, the Jerusalem Post brought this out on their piece, is that while he might try and start one of these wars, if a leader does that, he actually gains in popularity amongst the Palestinians if he starts an armed uprising against the Jews. And what we're looking for, and what Bible prophecy seems to indicate, is that a Hamas takeover or a growth in popularity is soon to happen inside the West Bank, the other Palestinian territory that they don't currently control. That's controlled by the more moderate Fatah, and it's been controlled by them for decades. Hamas has never ruled over the West Bank. And if disgruntled Palestinians inside the West Bank, which they are, disgruntled Palestinians with the leadership, their current leadership, get fed up and they look over to the Gaza Strip and they see a strong, charismatic leader, and he is. We've included a video in the article that we're publishing on thetrumpet.com of his speech that he gave right after he came out of prison back in 2011 that people can see him rousing the troops. If those in the West Bank see a charismatic leader leading over Hamas inside the Gaza Strip, maybe they too will want that man to lead them.
Well, yeah, it makes you wonder if well, there are certainly followers of Hamas within the West Bank, even though they don't Hamas doesn't have political control over that territory. They would still have quite a few who would be sympathetic to their cause, and you do wonder if the rhetoric and the symbolic nature of what's happened within the Gaza Strip would actually filter into the behavior of many Palestinians in the West Bank.
For sure. I mean, yeah, it's good to mention that. It's not like all the Palestinians are diehard Fatah supporters or diehard Hamas supporters. They do change. They do change where their loyalties lie. And we even talked about this late last year when we had municipal elections that were announced by Fatah inside the West Bank. They were announced because they thought that Hamas wouldn't participate in them and it would be a free way to reassert their control, Fatah's control over the West Bank. But then Hamas said that they would participate. And then the ruling party, which happened to be Hamas, canceled. Fatah canceled those elections because they were worried that even at the popular vote, there would be enough Palestinians in the West Bank that would want Hamas to rule.
One now, could even foresee Hamas, Fatah actually having to track a little bit more radical in order to claim the sympathies of those who would maybe who would like what they see happening in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, that at the least I feel has to happen. They would have to move that way to retain some of their leadership over the West Bank. But that said, I think there is coming a time real soon when Hamas finally does move to get control of the West Bank as well, and the population is going to want it wholeheartedly.
Oh, just to conclude, maybe you could, and this is a little bit hard to speculate, but putting all of this in the context of what we're seeing happening between Israel and the United States and Israel's position, they've actually, obviously under Netanyahu's leadership, they're feeling a certain amount of security with more strengthened ties with Washington. Obviously, Netanyahu this week in the United States, and I'm sure shoring up that relationship to some degree or another. How do you foresee this maybe playing out, and how much does this accelerate the timetable of what we expect to see in biblical prophecy in Jerusalem?
Well, I think it's important to note, just when it comes to Mr. Trump, just how much he, yes, has said that he's going to be supportive of the Jews, but also the fact that he said that he wants a deal with the Palestinians and the Israelis. And Hamas getting control, further cementing themselves over the rulership of the Gaza Strip and then into the West Bank, means that if you want a peace deal, you're not going to just have to work with a right-wing Israeli government. You're also going to have to work with the leader of the Palestinian people, which may prove to be Hamas. So it's going to make that desire that he has of a peace deal much, 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 much harder. And I was even reading a piece today how it's not just looking at the two personalities of Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Trump. They are both very powerful figures that care most about their own countries, as they should. And if he wants a peace deal, Mr. Trump, he's going to have to put Mr. Netanyahu in a very difficult situation to give concessions to somebody like Hamas. I mean, he wouldn't do that. So that might even play into some future breakup between the United States under Donald Trump and the Israelis, this current situation. If he pushes too hard, Mr. Trump, for a peace deal, which may be forcing Israel to deal with the Hamas-led Palestinians directly.
Very volatile situation, and these events made it more so this week. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Palestinian politics and the effect on the Arab-Israeli peace process. He's written an article, Hamas Installs New Charismatic Leader. That is up online on thetrumpet.com. You can find it there. Brent, we always appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
There have been some eye-poppingly disastrous weather events in the United States in recent days. Deadly tornadoes in Louisiana last week, and a very dangerous situation playing out in California with flooding rains putting hundreds of thousands of lives in jeopardy because of an unstable dam. Trumpet writer Sam Livingston has written an article. It's been posted online at thetrumpet.com with a very provocative title, Oroville Dam Crisis, More Proof That California Is Cursed. I have trumpet writer Sam Livingston via Skype from England. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Mr. Hilliker. How are you doing?
Doing terrific. Well, let's just start by talking a little bit about these tornadoes in Louisiana. What happened there?
Well, last week there was a series of storms that came in to the Louisiana, the New Orleans Bay area. And I'm not a chief meteorologist by any means, but this is definitely an area where we don't see tornadoes happen all that often. And especially during this time of the year, early February is not known as tornado season. And just the pictures are very it's just a very grave situation that you're seeing in an area that normally doesn't see tornadoes. Just these funnel clouds appearing speckled all around a major city of New Orleans, and then happening in certain areas that are still recovering from the disaster of Hurricane Katrina. And you're looking at urban areas. You're seeing massive funnel clouds touch down. I think they said it was a total of 7 tornadoes that swept through this area. And again, just a weird phenomenon.
Doesn't usually happen this time of year. It's unusual.
Sorry?
For this time of year.
Exactly. It's very strange. And especially the amount of them happening in that concentrated of an area. I don't think I've ever heard of anything like that.
Yeah. So has there been any speculation as to what might be causing it at an unusual time of year in an area that you wouldn't normally see this type of thing?
I've tried to look into it, just seeing what more analysts have said about it. It doesn't go much beyond that it happened. I'm sure someone out there is saying it's climate change is the cause of this. But
and what's
this definitely is an area that does get some strange weather from time to time.
What's the extent of the damage? Were there any fatalities?
No, there wasn't. There were no deaths, and it surprisingly did not cause a huge amount of damage. It hit most of the tornadoes touched down in some pretty rural areas. I think they did say it was about 15,000 homes that did suffer damage. But again, it did. Most of those tornadoes stayed out of the major metropolitan areas. But again, it happening around that area is strange nonetheless.
So let's move on to this story out of California. Tell us what's happening at the Oroville Dam.
Yeah, so last week, there were major rainstorms swept into Northern California. And it's just a strange story. We've obviously written about it in the Trumpet, California's crisis when it came to extreme drought. We had an infographic about it 2 years ago. And this lake in particular, Lake Oroville, it was just running dry. And these storms swept in a matter of just a few days, this reservoir, the Lake Oroville Reservoir, rose over 50 feet and began coming over the spillway, which is meant to alleviate the water flow so that the water doesn't come flowing over the main part of the dam. And the spillway had been damaged. It had some infrastructure problems. There were some cracks in it. And when they started having the water flow down there, it bit into those cracks and just eroded away this massive concrete spillway, to the point where they had to open up another spillway, the emergency spillway, which had never been used in the history of this dam. And then that filled up, and that is an earthen basin, and that eroded in just less than a day, causing just an uncontrollable amount of water to flow down into the river below, jeopardizing over 180,000 residents that live in that area with the potential of floods. And the water is now receding. The rain has stopped for a little while, and they're rushing to get in there to fix this problem. They say it'll cost hundreds of millions of dollars to get in and fix these spillways. And there's another rainstorm that they're expecting to hit in just a few days. So it'll definitely be interesting to see how they manage this crisis up there.
So this is really extraordinary that we're talking about these flooding rains in California, because it hasn't been that long since we were talking about record drought in California, looking at pictures of reservoirs that had been depleted and water levels that had dropped tens or dozens of feet. The reversal is amazing.
Right. It was just last year. It actually didn't even seem like it was weeks or months ago that this drought problem was still a huge crisis for California. They're struggling to get water down to the southern area of the state. Primarily, they rely on the water built from these, held back from these dams up in the north, and those reservoirs were receding. It was this huge problem. And then in just a matter of days, it's a total reversal where the drought crisis is then temporarily alleviated, only to be filled with this other crisis that is massive amounts of rain. And the Atlantic said it's just an ironic turn of events, but we obviously know there is more to it, as you can read in that article online.
Well, before we get to maybe some of the bigger issues, we also have the matter of just the infrastructure that has been aging. There have been some warnings that have come out against the possibility of something like this happening, and there are some people who are criticizing officials for having warned or having ignored those warnings, correct?
Definitely. There were groups warning about this over 12 years ago, that they needed to reinforce that emergency spillway with concrete. They warned that, you know, if water does flow into here, it could definitely erode away this earthen basin. And sure enough, that's what happened. The state didn't want to do it. They didn't want to put the money into the project. And they believed that these spillways could handle a lot more flow. And really, what was coming into those basins was actually a lot less than their capacity. And they still eroded and they still broke down. So they definitely underestimated what those spillways could handle. And yeah, they were warned. And this is, you know, something that could have been preventable for sure.
I guess when you put that in the context of all of the budget problems and budget shortfalls that California has been dealing with, it's not too difficult to see why a drought-stricken state would have maybe kicked the can down the road on some of these warnings regarding what might happen if flooding rains came. But I guess, as is the case in a lot of situations like this, it hits us when we're least expecting it. But your article, proof that California is cursed, you're not looking at this as just a story about aging infrastructure that needs to be improved in massive government work programs. You're seeing this in larger terms. Maybe you can just talk about this, because anyone who's been reading thetrumpet.com for any length of time, or the Trumpet magazine, would be aware that we've been talking quite a lot about California over the years and the series of problems that it has faced.
Right. Well, this state is it's definitely gotten used to just sorts of crises like this, from earthquakes, massive droughts, wildfires, and now flooding. They've had their share of emergencies. And like you said, we've written quite a bit about it. Yeah, I just wanted to look at the big picture with this, because we can talk about infrastructure, and a lot of people are saying, well, what can man do to prevent it? What could we have done to have stop this? And ultimately, it comes down to, you know, man is not controlling the weather, and they're trying to put all of these structures in place to lessen the impact of it. But what it does come down to is what Mr. Gerald Fleury said, you know, what he asked in that 2003 article, is California under a curse? And this, he wrote that in 2003. And that article, he's quoting himself writing in 1993, where there are also major earthquakes. California has been dealing with disasters like this repeatedly over the past two or three decades.
Right. California really seems like it is famous for making headlines along these lines. What is it about California that that puts it in the path of these kinds of disasters?
Well, like Mr. Fleury said, this is America's golden state. It was really, you know, the America's just that emblem of prosperity. And we know that there's just horrific sort of things coming out of that state in terms of just pornography and the movie industry. And like Mr. Fleury says, is this a curse for those sorts of sins? And then he also gets into explaining just the way the state also back in the 70s came after the Worldwide Church of God. And this is a state that has been very critical of God's work, and they're definitely feeling the wrath of that in that sense.
This is not something that you would tend to hear from many other places. A lot of people, I would imagine, would consider anything along the lines of some kind of a connection between the moral behavior of the people and the way that the weather is acting, as they would dismiss it as crazy. This is superstitious. This has no basis in reality. We need to look at things in a materialistic terms. We need to look at things scientifically. But really, the basis of what you're talking about gets back to several statements, a lot of information and passages within the Bible. We look at all world events through the lens of biblical prophecy. And when you're talking about geopolitics, it's biblical prophecies about this particular nation or this people that's doing this toward some other people. But there is a lot in the Bible about weather, and for us to completely push that aside and act like it has no bearing on in a modern world really is dismissing the veracity of the Bible and biblical prophecy, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's really, you know, when these sorts of events happen, there's no way for man to explain it away. These are things that are beyond what we can prevent, are beyond what we control. You know, we can't determine when the rain comes and goes. And Mr. Stephen Fleury talked about that in a recent Trumpet Daily radio show, where he referenced the example of the governor of Georgia praying for rain. And mm-hmm. these are instances where it shows how powerless man is to stop these things. And it really shows why man needs to be relying on God when it comes to the weather, praying for rain and praying for the rain to cease when there's too much. And God, you can read about that in many scriptures where he uses that as a curse. And there's drought in some parts of the country and flooding in others. And, you know, as sophisticated as man thinks he's gotten, as modern and all of these technologies that we have, we're still not able to escape that a massive amount of rain can just come from nowhere. And that really does show how weak mankind is.
Yeah, for the most part, we have insulated ourselves from so much of our interaction with natural phenomena. What has, say, the farmer who was out there in his field and who relied on rains in season and protection from pestilence and pests and so on, we've solved a lot of those problems by genetically modifying our food, by bringing in irrigation, by using fertilizers that give us the crops that we want, whether or not the soil is healthy. There are a lot of things that we've done to circumvent the problems that tend to be created when we have those interactions. But then these massive phenomena come along, and there's nothing you can do about a tornado. There's nothing you can do about flooding rains. And it reminds us of just how powerful nature really is, how powerful these natural phenomena really are. And if you're looking at it from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, it's not purely natural. There actually are spiritual causes behind some of these things that many people are unwilling to acknowledge. And yet they are helpless in the face of them when they do arrive. So it is a very interesting subject to look at and study into. We actually have a booklet that you can find online at thetrumpet.com. It goes into this subject in quite some detail and proves what the Bible says about it. It's quite a lengthy booklet, and it's worth studying. The booklet is called Why Natural Disasters. If you just go online to thetrumpet.com, you go under the literature tab, you can find that booklet, you can download that and read it online, or you can order a copy of that booklet from us and read it for free. We'll send you a copy at no cost to you. We've been talking with trumpet writer Sam Livingston about recent weather disasters in the United States, and particularly what's happening with flooding in California. He's written an article called Oroville Dam Crisis, More Proof That California Is Cursed. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Sam.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
It's time for today's last word.
What do you do in tough times? That's an important measure of a man. The Bible's verdict is clear. Proverbs 24 and verse 10 says, "If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small." We have to be tough. Toughness is a defining virtue. As Rudyard Kipling put it, you have to build the capacity to force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone. God wants to build that toughness in us, but he requires that we chase it down. His esteem for this quality is clear in many biblical examples, and perhaps the starkest is that of Jacob, who literally wrestled God himself. I heard a lecture recently that made use of this example, and it is an excellent one. The Bible doesn't give us a lot of details, but it's clear from the account in Genesis 32 that Jacob found himself in a midnight grappling match that lasted into the morning. Wrestling even a few minutes is exhausting. This contest apparently lasted for hours. And at last, this man, who was actually a God being manifested in the flesh, put Jacob's thigh out of joint. Yet as painful as that injury was, somehow Jacob summoned the will to keep fighting. Imagine wrestling with your hip out of joint. What Jacob did here demonstrated incredible tenacity and toughness. Just think about the fact that God deliberately threw out Jacob's hip and then kept wrestling with him. Clearly, he wanted to measure Jacob's character. And finally, this divine being said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." Jacob's response revealed his recognition of his respect for the superiority of his sparring partner. And it also showed the full measure of his own resilience and grit. "I will not let you go except you bless me." That's what Jacob said. Now that quality in Jacob deeply impressed God. And it was that quality for which God renamed him Israel. Israel, that name means Prince of God or Striver with God. And this being told Jacob, "Now Israel, for as a prince have you power with God and with men and have prevailed." This whole incident is such a vivid picture of the toughness required to be a part of spiritual Israel. God's people must be contenders, strivers, individuals who will drive themselves to struggle and fight as long as is necessary to attain victory. James 1 and verse 12 in the English Standard Version says this, "Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him." God tested Jacob's endurance and conquering spirit to its limit. And he's testing ours as well. There are times when our trials can become quite grievous. we're grappling with an adversary, and then just as it seems we're at our breaking point, our hip goes out of joint. Circumstances may seem overwhelming, impossibly demanding and painful. And at those times, we naturally want to quit and just be left alone to tend to our wounds and our injuries. But God demands that we keep fighting. We have to wrestle with unexpected conflicts, with protracted fatigue setting in, even with a hip out of joint. He wants to know how bad we want the victory. In our trials, we need to draw on God's power. We need to call on His help. Absolutely. That is critical. We also need to be like Jacob and maintain a dauntless determination in the face of that adversity to never give in, to never faint, to fight, and even to struggle with God for the victory. Develop the toughness, the princeliness of Jacob, the spirit that will say, no matter the odds or the pain, I will not let you go until you bless me. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks a lot to my guests today, Jeremiah Jacques, Brent Noctegal, and Sam Livingston. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. And I'll leave you with this thought from Lucius Annaeus Seneca. Just as wealth, however modest, grows through careful deployment if it is entrusted to a responsible guardian, just so our lifetime offers ample scope to the person who maps it out well. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.